Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another Wednesday evening with the Clear Mountain Monastery community. This evening, we're very happy to have Bhikkhuni Vandana, Aya Vandana, with us. Aya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'll just read a quick bio of you, and then we'll get into the questions. So, and as usual, people can put questions in the chat at any point, and about half an hour from now, we'll switch over to your questions. So, Bhikkhuni Vandana hails from Nagpur, Maharashtra, India. Born in Gujarat, she grew up in a family rooted in Maharashtra. She was ordained as a seminary or a novice at the age of 7 in 2005 under the guidance of her grandmother, who is also a Bhikkhuni. Starting her monastic life at such a young age, Bhikkhuni Vandana realized the lack of poor facilities for Bhikkhunis to train, learn about Buddhism, and practice. This inspired her to take action to support the Bhikkhuni Sangha in India. She received higher ordination in 2022 at Bodh Gaya, India, the place where the Buddha attained enlightenment. And currently, Bhikkhuni Vandana is in the United States to learn and practice the Dhamma with Aya Tathaloka Mahateri at Dhammadharini and Aranyabodhi. So she plans to return to India after the Vasa, or the rains retreat. So with that, just jump in, Aya. There's a lot about your biography, which is really outstanding. And I'm sure you have a lot of experience, which many of us don't. Maybe could you say a bit more about growing up as a seminary, ordaining at the age of 7? That's pretty impressive. So what led you into robes, and what has kept you in robes?
It's like, when I was young, I was not sure what I'm doing and at all, because that time we don't have that much Bhikkhunis at all. And I was so young that time. But as I grew up and I started to practice the Dhamma, and then I realized, okay, this is the path that so many people like want to follow it and want to come in the monastic life. But there's something that holding them behind, like they can't come because they are in samsara. They have so many responsibility to provide the families and provide the parents and everything. So that's why they can't come in the Dhamma. But their heart says that, okay, they want to go in the Dhamma. So I sometimes feel like, okay, maybe it's my merit that I am in the robes, and there's something that holding me. I don't know what's holding me in the Dhamma, but when I go in the Sangha, I feel like so happy, and I feel the love and compassion towards each others. And it's like we are pushing each other to, okay, don't give up, just do it. You can do that. And I think this is something beautiful that keeping me in the robes.
So thank you, Aya Vandana. And we first met just, I think, 2 weeks ago when I visited Dhammadharini, and your story was so powerful. And I find that I think your individual story is hard to, it's part of the cloth of your whole family's story. So would you walk us through just the sort of, the story of, you know, as much as you feel able, your grandmother to you and to where you are now, even just as much of that as you feel able to touch on. I know it's a huge scope, but what about your grandmother? Let's start there.
Before, she wasn't Buddhist. She didn't born Buddhist, but in 1956, when the Dr. B. R. Ambedkar, he revived the Buddhism, and he gave Dhamma to the people in the Nagpur. So she was 9 or 10 years old that time, and she went with her father to get Buddhism and turn into Buddhism. And from that, I think she got inspired, and when she realized the Dhamma, and I think she has some kind of feeling that people should follow this path, because this path is really precious. And sometimes she said this Buddhism is heart of Buddhism is the compassion. And I think she have compassion towards all the living beings, and especially for the human beings who are suffering. And she try really hard to teach them the Dhamma. And even now she's 86, but still she's trying to spread the Buddhism. And she's saying it was dream of Dr. B. R. Ambedkar, he want to make India Buddhist again, Buddhist country, Jambudvip again. So she said, until my last breath, I want to do that thing, and I want to make his dream come true as much as I can. Because of him, like she said, I come to know about the Dhamma, this precious Dhamma. So that's why she ordained everyone in our family to hoping that someone is go further and do more about this stuff, because she knows one day she will die and she can't continue this path. So maybe someone can do this, and maybe one day we can achieve that. So I think this is her journey, and she's always pushing us. Don't think that person is bad or that person is not good. That we should see with the compassion. Like I before said, the heart of Buddhism is compassion. So she always pushed me that. You should not see negative in the people. You should always see positive in the people. Like if there is a 99% negativity, but there is a 1% positivity in every person. So I think you should stuck with the 1% positivity with that person. So maybe you can get along with that person. If you see 99, even one negativity you will see, then you can't get along. Even that person have 99% positivity. So I think that's, I like what she said. And I really practice it, and I realize this is true. Buddhism is really compassion.
It's a really impressive role model to have from such a young age. So what was it like when you growing up in robes? Were you in a monastery, a nunnery? Were you at home? Did your grandmother, was she actively kind of teaching you how to be a nun the whole of your adolescence? Or what was that like?
When I was young, we used to stay in monasteries, and I used to go in school in the robe with the lay kids. And that time I really didn't know what is the difference in the robes and what the difference in the lay people. So I didn't care much about it because I was enjoying this childhood. So, okay, everything is fine. But she was teaching every day to us, because there's no training and there's no institution for bhikkhunis to get trained and get knowledge about Buddhism and practice about it. So when she ordained, there was no institute or nothing. So she learned by herself. She's not educated, but still she can read four languages. So she's read lots of book whenever she's free. She have her book in her hand, and until she don't finish that book, she will not leave that book. So she's addicted to read the books, and she said, you see what Buddha said and you should practice, you are very young. And sometimes she cried why I didn't come to know this Buddhism really early, and I didn't find a good teacher early in the age, otherwise I have achieved something in this path. And she's called me sometimes that you're so young, you should practice. So it's she pushing me you should do something, because you are already all along in this Dhamma. You come through so long journey and you are already a bhikkhuni. So you should always practice to encourage people also. If you're not practicing, you can't teach people correctly. So this is the thing.
That's beautiful, Aya. And so that speaks about how she taught you as a young seminary and into your teenage years. And then how did you come to take full ordination and come, what was your path after taking full ordination?
So according in the Maharashtra, everyone knows Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, he revived the Buddhism. So in India, especially in Maharashtra, if you ask people about the Dhamma, so they only know the book Dr. B.R. Ambedkar wrote. They only know about from that book, but they don't know about Tipitaka. So when I was young, and I also didn't know about the Tipitaka, but my grandmother, she used to teach me from the Buddha and His Dhamma, the book that Dr. B. Ambedkar wrote. And there is a Sekhiya, 75 Sekhiya. She used to teach me that. And if I'm playing or something, and I was just dancing or playing something, so she's you're a samanera, you should not do like that. And then if there's a nun or someone is doing something wrong, so she said, you see, this is not correct, you should not do that, and you should control your mind, body and speech. This is what Buddha said, and this is the proper for monastic. And if you are childish, then no one will pay respect to you, and this is not proper practice. So when you practice, you should control your body, mind, speech. So I was I'm so young for that. So she said, yes, that's why you should do that. Because in young age, when you start, then you can achieve something. Mm-hmm. So whatever she knows, she used to teach me, because there's a lack of knowledge of the Tama that time. But she teach me really well about that.
I'm curious, you mentioned a word in there which many of us who've been around monasteries will know, but probably most Americans wouldn't know, and that's Sakya. So these training precepts, which...
Yes, the Samaneras have the 75 precepts.
Yeah, and monks and nuns as well. It brings up this question just about language. And I know Pali has some relationship with Marathi. Was Marathi your first language, or what was your...
Marathi, no. As I say, I born in Gujarat, so Gujarati is like my mother language. But I can speak Marathi also.
Okay. And what, I'm curious about any useful resonances with the Pali when you were learning Pali, and as you continue to learn Pali, if there are things which you find in your mother languages, your original languages, that kind of, you have insights that people who didn't grow up with languages that were so close to Pali, I'm just curious about that.
It's like Pali and Hindi are like both part of Indo-Aryan language family. So they are like share some similarity, but they have significant differences as well. So both of us similar, but there's Pali can be written in Devanagari like Hindi and difference. But it's like Pali is ancient, used in Buddhist texts, and Hindi is modern language. But it's like Pali has more complex grammar, and many words are different. But like you say Pali words, so bhunjati. So in Hindi, we will say vah khata hai. So it means he eats. So in short, while they are share some roots, Pali and Hindi are quite distinct languages.
So you grew up trying to keep the sekiyas, the training rules, and your grandmother would admonish you when you didn't. And then can you tell me the path after your ordination to California? What, I know you went through Thailand and sort of have been gathering different training experiences. Can you tell me why you are in California now and how you came to be there?
Like I said before, like there's a lack of knowledge about Buddhism, especially for the nuns. So it's like I really wanted to study about bhikkhunis, about vinayas, about practice. And in India, there is no proper way especially for the bhikkhunis. So in 2019, Bhikkhuni Adimuti, she came to India. And through her, I came to know about Ayati, and I was in touch with her, with Ayati, and I told her that I really want to learn and I really want to practice about Dhamma more. But because in India, there's no place for bhikkhunis to get trained to practice properly. So in 2020, she invited me here to get her ordination at Dhammadharini. But because of like the COVID situation, I didn't get the visa. And because of that stuff, I stayed in India. And then in 2022, she said in November, she said in Gaya, there is a ITB BSI. They are arranging some high ordination ceremony for bhikkhunis who can't get ordination in their own countries. So I went there I had high ordination, 11-11-2020 in Gaya. And then there's a bhikkhuni from Malaysia, Bhikkhuni Sumangala. She knows me. I was in touch with her also. So she introduced me to another bhikkhuni from Thailand, Bhikkhuni Dhammavijjani. And she said that, Aya Sumangala, she said that you should go to Thailand with Aya Dhammavijjani, and you should stay with her and you should learn something from there. And I went to Thailand. I stayed there around 2 months in Thailand. And it was really different experience than India, because in India, it's like I never stayed with the monastics, like bhikkhunis at all. And I wasn't familiar with the vinayas, like, okay, how we have to behave with the senior bhikkhunis and the juniors, and when we go to Sangha. And it's like we every day we used to go for Pindapata and we eat together, and then every day we have some classes, like 1 hour, 2 hour Vinaya classes and everything. So it's like, it's really different. But I really wanted to come here also because I heard Ayati is really good at Vinayas. So I really wanted to learn from her also. And then last year I got visa and I told her and she just invited me here. So I'm here to learn from her also.
Yeah, something which is kind of a thread through this story so far is, I mean, kind of embodied when you said that your grandma said that she wanted to practice and was going to practice to her last breath.
Yeah.
You know, this is an aspect of the bhikkhuni training, which is often held as being understood to entail lifetime vows, which is something like in Thailand, certainly for bhikkhus, like there are a lot of bhikkhus who conceive of their monastic life is very short, you know, could be as short as 1 month or 3 months. And I'm curious how you conceive of that, the idea of lifetime vows and if you do think of that, how might you even offer words of encouragement to bhikkhus or bhikkhunis who feel a little bit daunted and afraid of making so bold a statement or bold an idea?
I was like, before when I didn't know about anything about Dhamma, so I was like focused on practicing because there was no flow at all because I'm just wandering here and there and I didn't have any proper teacher for teach me anything. And that's why I didn't have any confidence about me, about my practice, about my knowledge, nothing. But when I start to come in touch of the senior bhikkhunis who are really knowledgeable in the Dhamma. And then I start to practice the Dhamma. And then I start to realize that what is the real Dhamma and what is the difference in the lay people's life and what is the difference in monastic life. So it's like there is so many benefits when you are ordained. Like you can give your 100% to practice, but when you are in samsaras, like there is something is holding back. It's like even if I want to practice, there's something I have to do. I have to do for my family. I have to earn. And there are so many like maras. We can say like there are so many maras is like holding back in the samsara. And in monastic, we have nothing because we already left everything behind. And we already dedicated what we want from the Dhamma. So it was like, okay, now I'm getting like, okay, what I wanted. I really wanted to practice. And then when I start to practice, I realize step by step, okay, what is it? And before I was thinking why my mother was used to say it's like compassion is heart of Buddhism. And then when I practice it, then I realize, okay, this is why she was saying. So it's like when you have compassion towards others, so it's like the other people also have so much compassion towards you. It's like, it's not only you are giving compassion to someone else, but okay, you are also getting the compassion. So it's like, I believe enlightenment is not for ourselves. It's like more than lifting others from the sufferings and to make them free from the sufferings. It's like some kind of enlightenment. It's like if I think about myself, okay, I should practice more and I should only focus on my practice, then I'll be selfish. Like even Buddha said, you should not be selfish, like loba. I should not do that. So yeah, there's a people who really thinks, even when I didn't have any knowledge in the Dhamma, still people used to come and they used to ask like, we are living in samsara and we having some kind of issues. So how we can short out that stuff? But it's like I have no answer because I don't have any knowledge. But now when people comes and they ask and they're like start to practice Dhamma and they overcome from that thing, so I feel really satisfied. Okay, now I'm really on the correct path. Like, so it's only the realization that person have. So it's like if I don't realize what I'm practicing and if I don't have enough like self-confidence about me and if I don't have any faith in my spiritual journey, so no one can help me. I think one who's practicing that person should help, like embrace themselves, like self-discovery and intention. They should clarify their intention and they should ask guidance for their mentors, and they should also have faith in their journey and they should acknowledge their progress also. This is really important. Otherwise, I think monastic life is not easy without this stuff.
Thank you, Aya. What's one teaching from the Buddha that's really resonated or kept on echoing and coming up for you through all these years? Is there kind of one or two teachings which really has, you know, just keeps coming up in your monastic life?
Yeah, I think the four noble truths that Buddha have said, I think that that resembles me more. It's like suffering is like dukkha. The Buddha's teaching on the nature of suffering inherent in life, encompassing physical, emotional, and existence aspects. And second one is origin of suffering, samudaya, understanding the cause and condition, such as craving and ignorance that leads to suffering. And third one is like cessation of suffering, nirodha, realization that suffering can cease through the cessation of its cause, leading liberation and peace. Fourth one is part of the cessation of suffering, magga, the noble eightfold path. I think this is really important that person should realize that eightfold path, which includes right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right efforts, right mindfulness, and right concentration. But I think people don't see that. They only see the dukkha. They only see, okay, I have suffering. And that's all. And they think, okay, if I go to temple and I will tell the monk or nun, okay, I have this suffering, my sufferings will be gone. But Buddha said, you have to work on that for yourself. Yeah. Then there's another thing I like about impermanence, anicca, non-self, anatta, mindfulness, sati, compassion, loving kindness, metta, and ethical conducts like Shila. So this is really when I practice, I feel like this is really important, not only for monastic but also for lay people, if they really want to practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the background of many of those concepts, especially the traditional way that the Four Noble Truths are understood and the way that they're spoken of in the earliest texts is a belief in rebirth. That, you know, the second noble truth is the abandoning of craving that leads to rebirth. And I'm curious, I think you may have mentioned it earlier in the interview, but just what was your belief growing up? Like, was the culture that you were raised in, was it just totally normal? Did everyone believe in rebirth? I ask just because for many of us raised in Western cultures or in families that, you know, were scientific materialist families that just don't believe in anything, you just die and that's the end. It's even hard to imagine what it would be like to have that belief structure from such an early age, and curious what environment you grew up in and if that's changed at all, your beliefs about rebirth.
I think about rebirth in Buddhism, it's like a fundamental, according to culture, if you say about culture, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, like they believe when a person is die, so it's like atma, which is the soul. So it goes from one body to like another body. So, but in Buddhism, the concept of rebirthing is like fundamental. So it's believed that after death, being a reborn in cycle of like samsara, which includes like different realms, like human, animals, and heavenly beings based on their karma. So this cycle continues until one achieves enlightenment, like which is ultimate liberation from samsara. We don't know when it's, but in India, it's like where the Buddhism originated, view on rebirth was very wildly because the diverse religious and cultural landscape. Hinduism, the predominant religion, also believe, I can't find the word for that, sorry. So they believe in reincarnation. So, but with different details and in nuances. In Hinduism, the soul, atma, is enter and move from one body to another until it reaches the moksha, like liberation. But in Buddhism, it's not like that. So culturally, this belief is rebirth karma have significant influence on the people's life, ethical and practice. They encourage moral behavior as actions in their life to affect on the future's existence. This culture context might mean that many people in India, regardless of their special religious belief, have some belief of the idea of rebirth. But I think, like what Buddha said, until we got enlightened and we had to come in the circle of samsara. So I believe in that. I don't believe like my soul is go in someone else's body, and because I never feel that and I never saw that, but I have observed like how much karma is important in our life, and I have feel that, I have seen that, and I have observed that. So I believe in the recycled birth of samsara according to your karma.
When you talk about the need to bring this path kind of to ripple out the effects of your practice into the wider world out of compassion, I know that you have a journey and work that you're hoping to do back in India and before returning to India. So would you mind just speaking about what you're hoping to do in these next few years, and what you're hoping to bring back to India as well?
I was just hoping, like, Buddha is like, India is like ancient city where Buddha born and got enlightened and got parinibbana. So like Buddha has said four pillars of the Dhamma, who holds the Dhamma, like bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, upasak and upasikas. So in India you can see monks, but there's a lack of bhikkhunis. You can see upasakan and upasika, but there's no four pillar. So I think the four pillar must be strong there. If the fourth pillar is not strong, so I don't think the Dhamma will be balanced. It's imbalanced. So I just want to make the four pillars stronger as much as I can. So my intention is to bring the real Dhamma to India and provide the facilities to a woman who really wants to practice in the Dhamma. Because like according to Indian culture, they don't believe like a woman can live a spiritual life, and they don't believe like a woman can achieve something. Even in this 21st century, people don't believe like women can do anything. So I just want to make like change their point of view. This is not true. Even Buddha have accepted like women can attain the enlightenment. That's why he ordained a woman as a bhikkhuni. So it's just like bhikkhunis in India, they don't have proper knowledge. They don't have proper training. They don't have proper place where they can practice. They don't have proper support from people. Even in India, the lay people, they don't support as much because they believe men can do much. So they always support the monks, but not the nuns. So that's why I want to bring these teachings to India. Like, I feel like, Sanghamitta Theri, the daughter of Ashoka, she bring Dhamma from India to Sri Lanka, and I was feeling kind of like that. Okay, Jambudvipa is like a place of Buddha, and still like people don't know anything about Buddha, and we have to tell them about the Dhamma. What people brought from India to their country, but like Indian people don't know what they have. It's like they have the diamond, but they don't know the value about that. It is something like that. So my aim is that because I feel like I have lost so many years without the knowledge, and I don't want it to happen with other people who really want to practice in Dhamma. So that's my goal in the future.
Thank you, Aya. And your analogy of Sanghamitta, who traveled from India to Sri Lanka, is a good one, because if I remember right, wasn't in these next few years, aren't you hoping to go train in Sri Lanka for a time? And then can you lay out the practicalities of these next few years in terms of establishing a training center in India?
Yes, my plan is like, first, I want to get educated first. It's like, I should have proper knowledge about that. Otherwise, I can't teach. Like if someone have question and I can't answer. That's why I'm hoping for a few years, I will planning to go to Sri Lanka, then Thailand, and maybe in Taiwan and some other countries. I just want to observe more, like how they follow the Buddhism and how they follow the Vinaya. And I observe like in different countries, they have like different point of view on Vinayas, especially from like Asian country and Western country. I observe like some difference, and it's sometimes it's really hard for me to pick it up. Okay, what is it? So it's like it takes me so long to understand that stuff. But I think it's good to explore more about the Dhamma in the other countries and learning more, because there's no Dhamma is not small at all. It's really huge. So it's and after I get educated in the Dhamma, I'm hoping that all the bhikkhunis where I'm going, they will help me to teachings, like they can give some classes to the bhikkhunis from India also, and they can give guidance then how to follow and how to do that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really appreciate your summary and your grandma's summary that the heart of Buddhism, it's all about compassion. And I think that's somewhat unique. The American approach or the Western approach for many of Theravada Buddhism, people come to it because it's about oneself. It's about what I can do. And I'm the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, etc. And I think there are a lot of Western Buddhists or people who are secular Buddhists interested in meditation who actually don't have much of a foundation in compassion and the development of that. And I'm curious if you could talk about, I mean, your vision for your life, you know, going back, it seems like that'll be a multi-decade, if not a whole life practice, bringing Dhamma back, establishing training centers. And just curious how that developed in your own heart, this wish to give back and pay it forward and look out for the suffering of other people.
It's like since I'm a child, I was in the Sangha. So I have observed so many things, especially in the Bhikkhuni Sangha. So I have seen there's so many bhikkhunis on international platform. They have like recognition from people because they are continuously active on internet, on like live, YouTube, and so many stuff. And they have so much knowledge. That's why like people approaching them, okay, you should come, we invite you. But in India, it's like Indian bhikkhunis don't have any respect because they don't have any knowledge. And I feel when I like a teenager, like 15 or 16, and once we went to a program with monks and nuns, and I saw that monks getting all the respect, but the nuns, they didn't get any respect, because in Indian mentality, like men dominated country, so like they don't believe that women can do anything. And because some monks from India also don't accept bhikkhunis, so it's like people also not ready to accept the bhikkhunis. So that time I saw this is not equality what Buddha said, and this is not like good for bhikkhuni sangha if they don't get trained and if they don't have any self-confidence in the Dhamma. So I thought maybe because that time when they get ordained, they didn't have any facilities and they are not educated, that's why they are behind. But I'm still young and I can do something because I'm getting education and everything. And if I can't do anything for the Sangha, then what is the benefit of having the robe? So this is thinking is like coming in my mind. And then I talked to my grandmother about this, and she said, what you're thinking, it's not easy, because you are saying that you want to start all the things from the beginning. So it's like you're starting the revival of bhikkhuni from beginning. Because according to Indian mentality, it's not easy to push a woman, especially in the spiritual life. So this is why. And when I heard about King Ashoka's daughter, Sangamitta, so when I heard about her story that she went alone to Sri Lanka, a country where no one is Buddhist, no one knows about the Dhamma, no one knows about the Buddha, but still she worked hard and she spread the Buddhism in there, and it's still alive in Sri Lanka. So I was thinking, okay, this is the Buddha's country and everyone knows about Buddha and everyone knows about the Dhamma, then why I can't do that? So this is the stuff. And I was like, I'm not losing the hope. I think that's why everything getting along, I'm just going with the flow and everything is like turning into pieces now. It's like, okay, I'm getting on the right, correct direction. And yes, I just want that even a little I can do for the Bhikkhuni Sangha in India, maybe that's enough for me. I'm happy with that.
It's really beautiful. Something you said earlier in our talk was just about interpersonal relationships. Like, you can look for the 1% of good in somebody and not focus on all the bad things and the things which are criticism worthy. And just, you know, talking about the situation in India, there's a lot of, or in terms of monastic situation, there's a lot that someone could be angry about, that things don't, it doesn't seem like there's this equality. And one aspect of activism, and you even sometimes see it in Buddhist circles, is that, it's not difficult to see lack of equality, and it's not difficult to see how things are worthy of criticism. And I'm curious how you balance that, being able to look for the good in situations, but not be overly critical or aversive, or allow that kind of mind to take over.
Before, like I said, before I was not aware of Dhamma and any of teachings of Buddha. So that time I was really short tempered that time. Like if someone said something, I was got angry, and I was really hard to control my anger. And then my grandmother says, you are bhikkhuni and it's not good for you to be short tempered, because you never know the person who's coming to you is short tempered as you. So you're going to fight with that person or what? So then she said, Buddha said, if there's a person who's full and he's saying something, so you should keep quiet. There's no benefit of talking with the foolish person. So, okay, that hit my mind. Okay. Mm-hmm. So she also said one story, when Buddha was going for alms around, and there was a person came and he said some bad words to Buddha. And then Buddha didn't say anything. So then Buddha asked him, if you're going to someone's place and you're giving some gift to that people, and if they don't accept your gift, what you're going to do with that gift? So he said, I will keep that gift with myself. And Buddha said, okay, whatever you give me, I didn't accept that. So it belongs to you. So I was like, okay, that makes sense. So but still it's not make sense for me, because I was not really deep into the Dhamma. But then I start to read the Dhammapada. Read Dhammapada. And then I realized, okay, whatever we do, it's all karma. It's like body, mind, speech. And I realized, okay, so there's a fourth number of words, nahi vere na verane. I don't remember quite yet. But yes, it's like hated neighbor, we can't. I can't say in English. But I can't say in English what it was.
Hatred is never cured by hatred. Only through non-hatred is hatred stilled.
Yeah. So when I read that one, I was like, how does it make sense? It's not make any sense. Like if someone is calling me and I keep quietly listening that, and this is not I'm not doing anything for myself. Then someone said, you should practice. Buddha never said anything without proof or without practice. He never says useless things. So then I practiced it and I realized, okay, this is the thing. So from that day until now, I never get angry. Even something happened to me, I just remember that stuff. And I remind the Dhammapada Sutta's what he said. So I was like, okay, that makes sense. And until now, I think this is the Buddha's teachings, the suttas, it helps me a lot overcome from my angerness, hatredness, and everything.
Thank you, Aya. And just to say, people can type in questions in the chat if they want. We have about 10 more minutes, or maybe 6 more minutes, actually. But I remember we got on this live stream call about 15 minutes before things started, and we had a bunch of technical difficulties, and you were just cracking up the whole time. And I've noticed this about you, is this lightness and levity, and talking about how the Sangha, how to go into in India, where Buddhism hasn't been alive for so long, and yet, you know, to really feel this resonance, like, people are ready for that teaching to come back and be accepted again. Do you feel like there's a certain, you know, something in the Indian culture in the heart, which really sort of speaks to this aspect of compassion in a really powerful way? Or, you know, what sort of, yeah, what echoes of Buddhism do you see in India right now, just as it emerges again?
In India right now, the situation is like people come to know about Dhamma through the meditation. It's like when people have suffering, they come to monastery, like before I said. So in India, it's like people come to know the meditation, they start practicing meditation, and they feel some peace from inside, and they start to say, okay, this is something good and we should do, and then they come to know in the Dhamma. And recently some monks from Sri Lanka also came into India, and they're giving Dhamma talk in Hindi, especially Hindi. So I think this is really good for the people who really want to understand the Dhamma, and they're really good in giving Dhamma. And it's like in India right now, there's really active monks who are like went to Sri Lanka, who went to Thailand, who went to some other countries to learn Buddhism, and they come back to India, and then they start like training center for the boys who want to get ordained for lay people. And it's like doing really good. I think maybe in future, if we have Bhikkhuni Sangha also, so the women's group also, the lay women's group also be strong in India. And maybe in future, I think after more than 10 years, after 10 years or something, you can see Buddhist people, especially in Maharashtra. I'm not sure about other countries, other states, but I'm sure about Maharashtra, it will be strongly Buddhist.
Hmm. Wonderful. Yeah, sadhu. We got two more questions, which are really a few more, which are great. So maybe a lightning round. So many thanks, Aya. Very inspiring. Is there any country that you know or can recommend as most conducive in these times to ordain as a bhikkhuni or to practice sincerely as a laywoman?
I haven't been in Sri Lanka, but I went to Thailand. But I think it's really good to go there because in ancient time, like Buddha used to go to alms around, and they used to practice meditation and chanting in there every morning. So I think in Thailand, but it's here also, it's good, like they're practicing. It just depends on you, how you dedicated, how much you are dedicated towards the Dhamma. It's not about country or something. It's just on you, how you practice it. If you are not mindful and you are not really faithful with yourself, and especially with the practice. So wherever you go in this country, in this world, you will not get anything. But I think it's with ourselves, how dedicated we are and how really we want to practice it. So you can do it here also, in USA also.
That's perfect, Aya. Okay, we got one more. Yep. What ways did you cultivate compassion early in your practice? How do you see the 1% good in people? Thank you.
So... like I said before, I didn't know about Dhamma, but I start to learn Dhammapada, and then I come to know about the karma, like how the karma works in our life. So everything comes in front of us because of our karma, and sometimes it's not our karma, sometimes it's other person's karma that's happening and it's coming to us. But it's like Panya, it's like conscious mind, like we should be aware all the time what is happening. So when something happened, we quickly react on that. So like I said, I was short-tempered before, so I was react quickly on everything. But after practicing the Dhamma, so I don't react quickly. When something happened, I just observed before, and I tried to identify the situation. Is it a karma or something else? Then I should react on like that on. So it's like, if someone is doing bad to me, so it's not my karma. But if I do something bad toward that person, then it's my karma. So I see one person, okay, one person, that person is negative because I don't know about anything that person. But he's doing bad now. Maybe if I know something more, maybe that person has something in her past or his past that make him like that or make her like that. We never know about someone's situation, what's going on. So it's like we should observe that, why that person is like that. So when we see through the compassion, so we never get angry. But if we don't have compassion, so we'll get angry when someone is doing good for us. So.
Thank you, Aya. And may we all be able to follow those instructions. We just want to really thank you. We have to wrap things up. And as people will know, we usually will have a Zoom session following this from 6:45 to 7:30. We're posting the link into the chat for people who want to join us. Aya Vandana should be joining us as well. And Aya Vandana, if people want to support you or contact you, we have your permission to put your contact information in the description of this video. Yeah. So we'll do that.
Yeah, sure.
Is that the best way for people to get a hold of you if needed?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
And just, I think Ajahn Kovinla and I just both wish you all the best on your journey. And we're so grateful to have met you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.